Happy to present to you the Reverend George W. Weber. With his wife and four children, he lives and works as a minister in the East Harlem Protestant Parish of New York. This is a classic inner city situation which has been very graphically described in Bruce Kenrick's volume, Come Out the Wilderness. Anybody here read it? Good, there are a lot of hands back there. The inner city pastors are apparently all sitting back there in the inner classroom. Those of you who have read it know some of the tremendous things that Bill Weber, as he's called, has done. He's also part-time associate professor of practical theology at Union Theological Seminary in New York. He has worked his way through Harvard and Union Theological Seminary. He's done graduate work at Columbia, where I believe he has acquired his PhD. Close. The last speaker is close, too. He has served as dean of students and associate professor, as we said, at Union Theological Seminary. And East Harlem Protestant Parish is sponsored by several denominations since its beginning in 1948. He's written numerous articles concerning the work in East Harlem for such periodicals as Christian Century, Religion in Life, and Advance. His first name is George. We're going to let George do it, but we don't call him George. Everybody calls him Bill Weber. He takes Bill evidently from his middle initial, W. Does that stand for William? Very good. Bill Weber.
Let me give you just one word about the situation in which I come so you can identify the credentials that bring me here. East Harlem is not the Negro ghetto of Harlem located north of Central Park in New York City, but a multiracial, low-income ghetto. East Harlem is a neighborhood of 30 blocks north and south from 96th Street to 125th on Manhattan's Upper East Side. It's about 6 blocks wide, so that in total area, it's a little over a square mile. My hometown of Des Moines, Iowa, is approximately 100 times as big in geographical area. But East Harlem has a good many more people than Des Moines, Iowa. When I first encountered it in the fall of 1947, there were about 215,000 people living in that one square mile, perhaps the densest neighborhood in the face of the earth. Some sociologists figured out that if everybody in America lived in the same density as these people in East Harlem, you could get the whole country in half the geographical bounds of New York City. The discovery of East Harlem was a shock for someone who had been born and bred in Des Moines, Iowa. When my wife, some years after she had married me, discovered I was going in the ministry, this was horrifying enough, but the fact that we were going to go to seminary in New York was even worse. And I remember making an agreement that as soon as our 3 years in New York was up, we would go back to some typical, lovely Midwestern city where people could have normal lives. Well, East Harlem was a terrific shock to somebody who had this kind of attitude toward New York City. When I first encountered it with its squalor and its poverty and its human problems, it was a tremendously discouraging experience. But the problem changed its focus for me, if my understanding is right, when I came to the conclusion, reluctantly, that the problems of these inner city areas, like East Harlem, with its multiracial community and its human needs, isn't a peculiar esoteric backwater, a kind of poverty-ridden remnant of poverty in a big city that's really untypical of American life. But I would suggest, and I believe this now very firmly, that the problems which the church encounters in its inner city neighborhoods in Cleveland and Chicago and Detroit and St. Louis and Los Angeles, that here one sees in a very drastic way a picture of what's happening in American culture, in the urban industrial world in which we all live. and that instead of being something peculiar and strange, here you see, perhaps a bit grotesque, perhaps exaggerated, but directly the crucial problems which confront our culture and our life, that we live in an urban world. I have one little proof text for this. A couple of years ago, I was invited by the chaplain of Yale University to preach at Yale. They still have a quaint custom in New Haven that the president of the university greets and escorts the visiting minister into chapel. President Whitney Griswold had never heard of Bill Weber, and he'd never heard of the East Harlem Protestant Parish. But in the roving room, we had 15 minutes to kill. And trying to be a gracious host, he found out where I was from. Having discovered this, he said, "Well, you'll be interested to know, Mr. Weber, that I've been reading the important literature in the field of juvenile delinquency." I thought, gee, that's a good conversational gamut, but I thought he was kind of exaggerating. Why would he, an economist or a professor of history or something like that, why would he be reading all that kind of literature? So rather snidely, I said, "Could you tell me the title, sir, that you found most helpful?" Thinking that that'd stop him. Whereupon I got a list of 15 or so of the important books in the subject. And rather abashed, I said, "Why have you been reading all of those?" And he said, "Because it gives me the best possible insight into the Yale undergraduate mind." Now, I'll admit it's a little unfair for a Harvard man to tell that story, but it's true. And it is precisely the point I'm trying to make. Increasingly, I'm rather amused and troubled yet to discover that the problems which we see so clearly exposed in the inner city, the breakdown of family life, the lack of meaning in work, and so on, the changing sexual mores of our time, the things that hit you in the face in East Harlem that nobody hides, turn out to be the problems which are intruding their way into the suburban churches where my seminary classmates are pastors. And that we do face an urban world, and there are a great many books which can justify this same point. Paul Goodman's Growing Up Absurd, Conant's book Slums and Suburbs, and others, which are trying to suggest that in the inner city, one does see a picture of the crucial issues with which we are confronted in our life. Now, if this is true, the second fact of encounter in East Harlem was even more tragic. That is to say, that most of the Protestant denominations, the traditional Protestant churches of America, including the Lutheran, Congregational, Episcopal, and Baptist, and Methodist, and all the rest. It was a fact that in East Harlem, in the fall of 1947, there was not a single church of a major Protestant denomination, not one, ministering to the 215,000 people that lived in East Harlem. We have evacuated the inner city like the plague. Oh, there were a few churches left there. There was a Methodist church up on 118th Street. On Sunday morning when I went on Palm Sunday in the spring of 1948, there was a minister, three ladies, and two children in a sanctuary seating 600 people. He lived next door and felt as though he lived besieged by the world. There was a Presbyterian church which used to minister to Italians who have since moved all over New York City because, being good Calvinists, they made the grade economically, and they become part of the middle class, and a few of them still wandered back on Sunday morning to worship in a church that during the week has to be guarded by a high iron gate, kept continually locked. There was a Missouri Synod Lutheran church and a Reformed church in America, ministering to blonde, blue-eyed Anglo-Saxons who had used to live in East Harlem, but have long since moved away. This was the overall pattern, and I hope I don't have to labor the point that this has been the fact of the Protestant withdrawal from the city. Now, the tragic fact is, twofold. Not only that we aren't there, but that we didn't feel any concern about it. When challenged, the denomination said, quite simply, the people that live in the inner city aren't our kind of people. By which they meant that our denominations in America have had an historic responsibility for special groups of the population. You know that better than I do. I'm a Congregationalist because the Congregational Church is strong in New England and in Iowa, where Congregationalists move. The Congregationalists, we know the people who belong in our churches, middle class, English stock, who will respond to an educated ministry. That's our kind of person, and we build churches where we find that kind of person. And so our denominations have tended basically to orient their ministry to those for whom they feel a particular responsibility. And the fact is that when you look at the 215,000 people that lived in East Harlem, none of our major Protestant denominations felt any responsibility for them. They weren't our business. They were somebody else's problem to evangelize. The second thing the denomination said was, get off your high horse, you seminary students who think you've got such a problem on your hands in East Harlem. The people that live there already go to some other church. They're Jewish, and they go to a synagogue, or they're Negro, and they go up to Harlem to a big Baptist church, or they're Puerto Rican or Italian, and they're Roman Catholic. This answer might have worked 30 years ago, but it doesn't work anymore. When you sit down and investigate, you discover that the overwhelming percentage of people that live in an inner-city neighborhood like this never set foot in any religious institution from one year to the next. John Benedict, who had a simple little test that he used to convince the denomination. It wasn't very scientific. It wasn't very elaborate. It was as simple as this. He and another seminary student got up at 5:30 one morning, went to East Harlem, and planted themselves on either end of a tenement block where about 2,000 people lived between 2nd and 3rd Avenue on 102nd Street. About half were American Negro and half were Puerto Rican. And from 6 in the morning until 1 in the afternoon, they kept track on a lovely spring day in Lent of the number of people that left the block on the assumption that they could be going to church somewhere. Out of the 2,000 people, 26 people left the block. Now, give them the benefit of the doubt and assume they went to church. I suspect they went to visit relatives in the Bronx, but if that's a little over one and a, that's not quite 1.5%. And everybody knows that a Catholic has to go to church on Sunday and a Protestant ought to go to church on Sunday, and that's pretty much your unscientific proof that East Harlem is a pagan community. And so it is with most of our great inner city neighborhoods in these days. The Catholic Church has no firm hold any longer either on these situations. Now, I only go into this somewhat long picture because I'm not here to describe primarily the East Harlem Protestant parish. But my reason for being here is that I got dumped down into this situation with a number of other clergy and ministers from a variety of denominational traditions to try and, if you will, witness to the gospel in this context. And I am affirming that here the church faces the crude, rough, but real realities of the modern urban life with no holds barred. And in the second place, not only are we by no virtue of our own dumped into the situation where the church is head on against the issues of the modern urban situation, but we got clobbered. We tried to reproduce the traditional patterns of the churches in which we grew up and in which we were taught as seminary students at seminaries like Union and Yale and some of the denominational schools. We simply tried with the energy and dedication and consecration and brilliance of young, enthusiastic clergy to prove that the old patterns had worked. Maybe we weren't so hot as we thought, but I'm also prepared to argue that the traditional patterns of Protestantism, forged to meet the needs of a rural America 250 years ago, stemming from a Reformation world of 400 years ago, have very little usefulness when the church faces honestly its confrontation with an urban culture. And the joy of this ministry, and the reason why I want to come here to share something of the struggle of these 15 years, is precisely that by being set in this context where the problems are exposed, and by being interdenominational, this parish has been given a rather unique freedom to look for the structures which God is always seeking to give his church to do his work. By freedom, I mean this, that on Sunday morning, those who gather in one of the storefront churches or buildings of our parish represent every religious tradition under the sun. If they're Puerto Rican, they come from a Pentecostal or fundamentalist or Catholic or no background. If they're Negro, they come from Methodist or Baptist or sanctified or no background. If they're West Indian Negroes, they are Methodist or Anglican. Here, nobody can say to the minister, Pastor, we've done it this way for 50 years, and we intend to be doing it the same way 50 years after you've left, which is what so often happens in a church situation. It means that you have a freedom to look for patterns of obedience in the life of the church that will be relevant to the situation in which you find yourself. Also, by being interdenominational at the board level, because eight denominations help support and direct this parish, It's really been very difficult on the poor denominational executives. The Methodist can't make you do it the Methodist way, heaven forbid, or the Baptist way, or the Presbyterian way. Each denominational executive I know at the national board level tends to have, at least 15 years ago, a pretty good idea about what he expected his denominational church to be and do and look like. The monthly report made this very obvious. There wasn't much freedom to take seriously the need for the church in our day to find new patterns of obedience. But because it was interdenominational, this parish has been able to get away with a radical opportunity for experimentation over these many years. So that the reason we would respond to the suggestion that we come and share for 4 days with a group like this, not because we have any answers, but because we have been plunked down in what I take to be the crucial kind of situation for the church, where the old answers haven't worked, and where by the grace of God, we've been given freedom, an unusual kind of freedom, to look for new patterns. By that freedom, let me just give you one illustration. I come from a very liberal social gospel church in Des Moines, Iowa, a congregational church where I'd never heard the gospel as a kid, really, but where you never would think that people cared very much about the structure of the church's life. A minister that had some theology went there 6 years ago and suggested to the board of deacons and the congregation that they ought to change the offering from early in the service, where it provides an excuse for the choir to sing, to a place after the sermon as the response of God's people to the preaching of the word and as the beginning of the service of Holy Communion. Well, he's tried this for 6 years, and the offering is still where it always has been. And you can't even figure out why people care that much. But in the church where I work, in a remarkably humiliating situation, I work as a part-time assistant to a brilliant ordained woman minister. I hope you never subject yourself to this possibility. She got the bright idea one Sunday that we ought to worship as a family. So on Wednesday, had a meeting of the section and suggested that we take the communion table out of the chancel, where it had been since the church was built, and pick up all the pews in the church and put them in a circle and put in a square and put the communion table in the center of the whole church. Well, the section thought this over and sounded like a pretty good idea, so on Friday we had a work party, and on Sunday the whole furniture has been rearranged. This is what I mean by freedom, a kind of freedom that, that most people are never going to have in their ministry. Well, this has been a long prolegomena, but I want to make clear, it's not a matter of answers, but the freedom to face clearly and directly and harshly the city in which we live, and to recognize the possibility that God is always seeking to give his church the patterns which it needs to do his work in the changing culture in which we find ourselves. Now, the problem, I would suggest, is quite simply the fantastic inflexibility of the church's life. The World Council of Churches, in this period between the last General Assembly and the next, is giving a major study time to a study called the Missionary Structure of the Congregation. The German Lutheran pastor, Hans Margul, who was directing the study, suggests its necessity for this reason. He says that we've done a lot of solid theological thinking in the last 15 or 20 years about the nature and mission of the church. There's a whole shelf of books on renewal that have been written for the sake of the church. And I am prepared to argue that there is a remarkable theological consensus emerging that goes right across the Christian spectrum from Catholicism to Southern Baptist Convention, in which the church is discovering that it must say the same similar things about the centrality of a biblical witness, about the renewal of the laity, about the church as the instrument of mission, about the need to take seriously the lordship of Jesus Christ over the church and over the world. That there is a great deal of solid theological work which churchmen of an incredible variety of traditions are beginning to emerge with a common mind or concern. That is to say, for example, the seminal book on the laity was written by Yves Congar, a Roman Catholic priest. on the lay people in the church. The book that has been determinative in much of the Protestant thinking since this was published some 10 years ago. Now, in this theological consensus, in this new understanding of the nature and mission of the church, I have discovered in 15 years that the seminary students whom I have known have gone out into the church with a new theology, a new theological understanding, and have run head-on against the inflexibility of the institutional structures of the church. The World Council has coined a phrase to describe this problem. Hans Margul now calls it morphological fundamentalism. I practiced saying that before breakfast for a month so that it would come out with a certain kind of authority, and I hope you'll do the same thing. Morphological fundamentalism is a big way of saying the rigidity of institutional structures. Just as the Bible has been taken as literally given and the unalterable word of God, so-called biblical fundamentalism, so I would suggest that right across the denominational picture in Protestantism today, the present rigidity of our ecclesiastical structure, the assumption that the way we do things now are the way God gave them to be done and that they cannot really be changed, this seems to me to be the overarching problem of Protestantism in our day. At least this is the assumption of the World Council and its study. The missionary structure of the congregation is an effort to say, if we can begin on the assumption that the church exists for mission, as God's instrument of work, witness, and service in the world, then what are the structures which are necessary to do this task? Now, in order to advance on this problem of the missionary structure of the congregation, and to face the problem of morphological fundamentalism, and I suspect that most of you in this room would recognize what I'm talking about when we use this phrase, can define in your own experience the way in which the present patterns of your congregation and your denomination are now as sufficiently rigid as to be a real problem in terms of meeting the changing needs of an urban society. In order to advance, the necessity, I think, is of dialogue. That is to say, the church must not go back and study theology harder, read more renewal literature, write more renewal books, read more intensively in the Reformers and in the New Testament and Old Testament, more theological study in order to find the shape of the church that we are going to apply to an urban culture. But I think the only way in which we shall advance is to take seriously another ecumenical okay word that's already a little hard to say without choking, that is to say dialogue. It is not as though we have in our theological resources and our tradition the answers somehow to be given in completely to the situation in which we find ourselves. That we must take our theological understanding and figure out how to manipulate or twist or make it jive with the particular situation of the world. But I would argue in our discussion that the Christian, as his Lord, must take seriously the necessity of a genuine incarnation and involvement in the world. And in his involvement in the world as a man, and in his theological study and reflection, in the dialogue between what is happening in the modern urban situation, through his involvement and self-understanding in it, he must seek to understand and apprehend the gospel, and he will understand and apprehend the gospel more fully in dialogue with the world in which he finds himself. This is perhaps a little hard to illustrate, but I have one illustration that helped me get some kind of gut reality out of what I'm talking about, and it comes from Pastor John Gensel in New York City. Somebody told me that Gensel was a pastor to jazz musicians. That sounds pretty esoteric and intriguing. So I went to see Pastor Gensel to ask him what he did and what the point of it was. Well, it was a very illuminating experience because this guy is not an offbeat character at all. He's a very sensitive Christian, theologically astute. And what he said was this, that his job was to go into a very village and to share in the life of the sensitive, brilliant jazz musicians of the village and of Harlem. Many of them Negroes or other minority group members who recognize and feel the anguish of depersonalization and the tension of urban culture more strongly than anybody else. And in living and sharing in their world, Gensel says that he has had to rethink substantially the whole meaning of his Christian faith. that it has brought a new perspective into his biblical study, that this is a kind of dialogue in which he, as the Christian, it must be engaged in his theological reflection in the context of his involvement in the world. For him, this has created something of a theological revolution. Funny thing, he said, was that when Big Shot Lutheran executives come to New York for board meetings, the thing they all want to do is spend a night out in the village with Gensel. It's one way to get to the village respectively, and it also could be on the expense account. And so he has quite a troop of denominational and ecclesiastical big shots who go out of the village. And he says, it's always funny to see what happens, because about 1:30 or 2 in the morning, they start getting restless. He's been sitting there, people have come over to talk to his table, he's gone off in the corner for an hour, a bull session with, or a profound discussion with some musician or somebody. But he's just been sitting there, and they find, Pastor Gensel, when are you going to get your pick? When are they going to let you have the mic and do something religious? Well, he's not going to do anything religious in the sense of getting up and preaching a sermon. He is there to be present, to share and witness and speak when asked, but not to do something that looks religious. And it always baffles these men, he says, because he doesn't have his chance to make his religious pitch sometime during the course of the year. Well, dialogue, that the kind of dialogue in which Gensel is involved doesn't permit this. Now, on the one hand, then, we as Christians must be involved in a dialogue with the world. We have every necessity to use all the resources at our command to understand the urban revolution in which we live, to try and figure out what in heaven's name is happening in the cities of our day. What is happening there to human life? What is the context in which we must witness to the gospel? Because I am persuaded that unless we really listen to what is happening in the world, understand its anguish and its needs, our efforts to make and witness to a relevant gospel are defeated before they begin. At least this is precisely what happened to us in East Harlem. Having decided to bring Christ to East Harlem from Union Seminary, we discovered that we had to find out what Christ was doing in East Harlem. And we had to learn to listen and share and be part of the life of the world before any ministry was possible. The interesting thing is, however, that when one begins to read the sociologists and the cultural anthropologists and the psychologists and all the other students who are studying the city, and you know that there are vast shelves of books by competent secular analysts who are trying to figure out what is happening to the city, one discovers again and again that the most secular writers say a profoundly biblical word to the church about what's happening in the city. What they say is that human life in the city is being destroyed, that it is not possible to live as a human being in the city. The overarching word which describes what is happening in our big cities is depersonalization. It doesn't take Christians to determine this word, but it also turns out to be the kind of word that Paul Tillich or other theologians use to describe what is happening to modern man. Now, in the inner city, the reality of depersonalization is very obvious. Depersonalization are 27 people living in 1948 in the four coal bins under apartment house 331 on East 100th Street. It's 4,000 people living between 1st and 2nd Avenue and the 27 tenements on one street. It's kids going to school where the parent never meets the teacher and the teacher never meets the parent. It's a mother beating a 2-year-old boy with a strap. It's a 10-year-old looking you straight in the eye and telling you the most blatant lie without any obvious sense of guilt or responsibility. It's a 15-year-old coming into a crowded room and shooting a boy with a gun when there is no possibility that he will escape apprehension and punishment. This is the effect of depersonalization. And yet, this is also the problem of the organization man. Those of us that were in the service had a number. Ride the subway and rush hour in New York City, it doesn't matter what your income is, the problems of depersonalization face you directly and rigorously. So that there's not time to define it, and it's not my job so to do. But I would suggest that half the dialogue, half the dialogue is that the church be willing once again to find out what the world is all about. But the problem is, the that the church has not been willing to find out what the world is all about. Isn't it fair to say that the church is about the last place to recognize the revolution in which we find ourselves? When I go home to Des Moines, Iowa next Sunday, when I wander through the streets of that town where I haven't really lived for 25 years, the changes are going to be fantastic. Much of the city will be unrecognizable. But when I go to Plymouth Congregational Church on Sunday morning, it's going to be just the same. Nothing will have changed there, including the soprano soloist. Yes, she'll be worse, but not much. There's a sense in which we do recognize to the great eternal truth. But there's also a sense in which the forms of the church have grown dead and empty and cold and irrelevant. Because we are not willing to recognize that the world has changed radically, and we do not live in the kind of rural culture in which our patterns of church life were formed. I have often reflected on, for example, the Billy Graham Mission in New York City, which the whole Protestant enterprise pretty much supported. And I do not reject it because it is unchristian or because Billy Graham is not a dedicated man of fantastic charismatic power. It's simply irrelevant. The overwhelming pagan mass of people in New York City have stopped listening to ranting preachers because the airways are filled with it. They turned off their earphones a long time ago. When Billy Graham is at the Garden, he reaches only those people whose lives are already within the shadow, the penumbra of the Christian faith. It is a revival for those who are called back. But the overwhelming mass of people who live in New York City, including the overwhelming mass of members in liberal churches like my own, I've never heard the gospel, and they're not people whose faith can be revived. And this is not a relevant method of reaching them. They simply do not hear an evangelist on a podium in Madison Square Garden. And yet, for the whole of the Protestant enterprise in New York City to support this as our great evangelistic thrust for a 10-year period is to throw in the sponge without a whimper. Yes, the church is a problem today. The problem of the church, in very simple form, three or four past things which have most troubled and threatened our own ministry in East Harlem. One is the disunity of the church. I shall not labor that again, but if East Harlem is a pagan community, where the 200,000 people who live there, 80% never set foot in the church, it is a profoundly difficult thing. If, as has happened, 10 major denominations all begin a new inner-city ministry in East Harlem, each functioning as competing institutions, seeking to bring men into their own institutional orbit. This is a very confusing thing to the pagan people of East Harlem. But the disunity problem that I want to talk about isn't primarily an ecclesiastical one. The disunity that is most troubling is the fact that our denominations have continued their ministry to particular groups in society. When I say to a Negro member of my congregation, "You are my brother in Christ," the chances of his believing that is really about zero. It's a preposterous statement. He accepts it for me as an honorable statement. I'm obviously a minister, and I'm paid to believe that and to say it, and maybe I'm even trying to live by it. But he knows that deep down in my heart, white men don't love Negroes in America. They're not willing to be their brother's brother. They're only willing to be their brother's keeper. He knows that the money which makes our ministry possible comes primarily from white middle-class suburban churches who are deeply concerned about the problems of East Harlem. But when I went out to Bronxville to speak to the Women's Association at their meeting, the woman greets me by saying, "Brother Weber," Mr. Weber, would say brother at a church like that. Mr. Weber, we're so glad to have you come and talk about the race problem in East Harlem because we don't have any experience of it out here in Bronxville. And I say, "Oh, you don't?" She says, "No, we have no race problem in Bronxville. We don't permit any Negroes or Jews to buy houses in Bronxville." So to live in Bronxville, you have to be a white Christian. Nobody else is permitted. And the people to whom I minister know that this is true. So that the disunity of the church its cultural and class disunity is an overwhelming problem for the ministry of the church in the kind of world in which we live. We shall talk about this at considerable length. The problem of the church was also that we live in a church, the denominations from which I come, that have pretty much our churches without the gospel. I hope this is not true of your ecclesiastical tradition. But in the denominations that are usually represented in the ministry in the inner city, we do not expect those who join the church to testify to a transformed life. We do not expect saints to be members of our congregation to reflect a total obedience to Jesus Christ, but we invite them to join an organization, a club. We assume we take for granted an amazing biblical illiteracy, though I am interested and intrigued to discover that that in Walter Kessler's studies and others, that you Lutherans turn out to be almost as biblically illiterate as we Protestants, as the rest of us Protestants, which is almost total. that your congregations are not much more likely than ours to know very much about the story of Israel and the traditions and history of our faith. But I think the overwhelming problem to which I would most want to point is the fantastic anti-urban bias of Protestantism. I was brought up in Des Moines, Iowa, in the YMCA, and on the nature kit. God was in sunset. At White Camp, we went up to Inspiration Point, and across the river, the sunset, and there was God. God was in this created world. We were real Jews. We were real worse than that. We were nature worshipers. And that's where you found God, in the beauty of nature, and on picnics. And you went out in the car with the family, and you had to live in a house and play outdoors and have a little garden. This was what makes it possible to be part of God's world. And everybody knew what happened to a little Iowa girl when she went to the big city. Cities were for the devil, and God was in the country. And Protestants have taken this so much for granted that we have fled our big cities as though they were filled with the plague, leaving behind a festering core of misery that pushes out faster than we can get away from it. But isn't it true? How many thousand times have I had somebody say, "Oh, Mr. Weber, how can you live in the slums there with your family? Isn't that an unchristian thing to do?" And it has been almost impossible for me to get over the brainwashing I had and discover that I like to live in the city. And that I think I'd die if I had to go back and live in Des Moines, Iowa. But it's hard to get across this idea that somehow cities are for the devil. You know, I guess you Lutherans know that the devil exists. It's hard, a hard time for me to recognize this, but I had a nice little story occurred the other day. Two of our six-year-olds were having a big theological debate in Sunday school. And one of them was overheard to say to the other, "Well, I sure don't believe in the devil." And the second one was very upset at this apostasy and said, "What do you mean you don't believe in the devil? What do you mean?" And the second little boy said, "You know, he's just like Santa Claus. It turned out to be your daddy." Decided that cities are not for people, and that to be a person, the Protestants have said you've got to live in suburbia, you've got to have a house. Ask anybody what his image of the good life is, and it begins by the pattern of some kind of home and a place where he can live in the nature, and a rejection of city life. I think it was my oldest boy that first began to help me realize the fact that this just didn't have to be this way, and I wasn't simply disloyal to my religious heritage in time to begin to discover that maybe East Harlem was a place that I liked to live. We'd had 3 months off one summer to go to Maine, and we lived in a lovely little cottage on the seacoast. Beautiful place out on the hills, on the seacoast in the pines. And we came back to New York on a ghastly hot August night, like last night in St. Louis, the heat steaming at 11 o'clock at night. As we came under the George Washington Bridge, Johnny, who was age 9, woke up and looked around and began to cry. "Heaven's sake, Johnny, this was most unlike this kid. What's the trouble?" And he said, "Gee, it's wonderful to be back in the city." Well, until Protestants believe that, we don't know what it means to live in God's Word. And the problem is that our patterns of organizational and structural life still assume a rural culture. We still assume that people can go to church on Sunday morning at 11 o'clock in an industrial area. We still presuppose that the church is the center of the life of the world. But now, as Gibson Winter and others are telling us, the church has become only the center of the little private world of family and residence, completely isolated and utterly insulated from the public realm of politics and economics and the world in which men make decisions and in which the battles for a human world are going to be entered into. Our Sunday school minister still presupposes that all boys and girls grow up in happy Christian families. Our parish, we've tried every form of Sunday school literature from every denomination under the sun, I think, from Moody Bible Institute to Seabury Press. And it's a funny thing that it doesn't matter what the denomination, their theology of Christian education is exactly the same. To be a Christian, you've got to grow up in a family where you have a daddy and mommy that love you so you can teach them about the Jesus' love, and where you have a father that's a wonderful father that takes them on trips in the family car and have prayers around the family table so you can say, that's what God is like. It all presupposes that you live in a Christian family milieu in order that the church can teach kids what the church is like. Or it's lucky that the New Testament's got it the other way around, or we'd have had it in the inner city. The New Testament says that I know what it means to be a father by the relationship between Jesus Christ and God Almighty. But this is the picture, and I take my image from that. And not the other way around. It also assumes that a single person is not a strange, queer person. That celibacy is a legitimate Christian vocation, so that single people are not queer ducks, necessarily. And it also assumes that I know what family life is in terms of the relationship between Jesus and his church, and not the other way around. It took a little while to discover this, because I didn't go to a seminary where I got a very good biblical education, but at least the Bible has it straight, I think. In other words, we've got to be willing to recognize our bondage, not to the faith of the Bible or to the Reformed traditions in which we stand, but to rigid structural patterns and ways of doing things that are attenuated, that have gone so far off the track as to bear little relationship to the ground in which they were sown, the root from which we come. My struggle, then, has been to learn to listen to the world, to understand it, the kind of world in which we live, to recognize the blindness of the church to this world, the unnecessary and ridiculous blindness to this kind of world, and in that context, seek again to understand some frame of theological reference which helps make this thing come alive and helps us see the shape of the church's ministry in an urban culture. The perspective which has made this possible is a rather strange one. The clue comes not from the Bible, but from the greatest secular student of political science, Aristotle. Aristotle is very concerned about cities. Aristotle says that men come together in cities for protection, and they stay in cities to live the good life. Now, I'm prepared to say that God makes it necessary for men to live in communities. This is the way we are made. This is an order of creation. And it's pretty obvious. The facts make it pretty inescapable that God has decided that most men are going to live in cities in our day. This is simply a fact of history. We live in an urban culture, and even when you live in the godforsaken little prairie town in North Dakota, where I once had a summer prairie, it's now part of an urban culture because of TV and the forms of the culture in which we live. We live in an urban world, and most men are going to live in huge cities, in great metropolitan complexes. Now, I believe that one can only affirm that God has put us in the cities, and not to make us suffer, but in order to live the good life. But it is an order of creation that men live together in cities. And instead of saying cities are for the devil, we must say cities are of God, and in which the devil fights the harder. But as long as we continue to believe to leave the cities to the devil, we are simply denying the context in which God is calling us to live in the middle of the 20th century. I believe that God is at work in cities. Now, Aristotle says something else.
He said the task of politics is to make and keep men truly human. Now, would you reflect on that just for 1 second? The task of politics is to make and keep men truly human. Now, I would argue that that's not a bad definition of the church, his ministry. In Jesus Christ, we know what it means to be a man. In Christ, we see the mirror of true humanity. Isn't that true? Isn't that what the Christian faith is all about? In Christ, we are given a new life. We become a new man. And the task of the church is to enter into God's work of making men truly human. And in this gathered life, the church is called to sustain us in our new humanity, to be the frame of reference, the new family in which the new Lord and the new vocation of our life can be experienced, trained, and lived out. So that in this rather, jolting way, I like to suggest to you that the task of the church can be defined in very secular terms as a political task. The task of the church, making and keeping men truly human, has as a parallel the precise definition which Aristotle uses for the task of politicians. This seems to me to be a frame of reference which accepts the city as the locus of the life of the Christian in our day, and which gives us a base of reference in which to combat the rigorous institutionalism of our day. Because now the question is, what is the task of making men truly human? Where is depersonalization taking place? Where is human life being warped and twisted? That's where God is already at work. That's where God is at work in Christ to make and keep men truly human. It is our job to join in God's task. When we ask ourselves what the task is, then God gives us the structures, the forms, the institutions that we need to enter into his ministry of witness and service. In other words, I am suggesting that we take seriously the Reformation. The Reformation, which was a reminder above all else that the institutional structures of the church always grow, if not corrupt, stale, irrelevant, and unrelated to the changing world in which men find themselves. Ecclesia reformata et semper reformanda. A reformed church that must always be reformed. Why should we be surprised at this fact? This is the truth that Luther knew. This is the meaning of our own heritage. But the Reformation to which we return, it is my profound conviction, is not to take seriously once again what Luther or Calvin or other reformers had to say, important as this may be and necessary as it may be, because most traditions who stand in the Reformation heritage have gotten a long way from their forefathers. But above all else, the method of Luther and Calvin, which was to return again, to reflect profoundly upon their own world situation in the context of a rigorous study of the Scriptures. And a humiliating and embarrassing thing about being a minister in East Harlem, in the midst of the radical experimentation in which we've entered, all the crazy things we've tried, they have almost all failed, unless they turned out to be directly rooted in the witness and faith of Israel and of the New Testament church.
We're very happy that we can get the second session of this most stimulating presentation by Bill Weber.
I would like again to be clear about what I shall try and do in these next three lectures. I have begun yesterday by saying we wanted to talk about the missionary structures of the congregation. And my concern, having dealt somewhat yesterday, hurriedly, with the city and with the problem with which it confronts us, is to suggest that the real problem for most congregations today is not primarily a theological one. That is to say, I suspect that in most of the denominations of Protestantism now, there is a process of very clear thinking going on in terms of the theology of the church and its mission. I have been pleased to discover in coming into a world that's very foreign to me ecclesiologically, that is to this group, to Lutherans, and to the Missouri Synod, Lutheran in particular, to discover familiar phrases and to realize that the seminary professors here and I have been reading a common literature. And I think I can justify the fact that there is a common movement of the Spirit through the churches these days in terms of the life and mission of the church. The problem, however, is not to find and articulate a theology of mission, but to take the consequences. The problem of missionary structures for the congregation is to make our theological affirmations have some kind of integrity by the way in which we express them in the life of our churches. And I shall take five theological affirmations, describe them only most cursorily, and then try and indicate how it's possible to take them seriously, to take the consequences in the actual structural life of the church. Now, I'll be clear about this. My purpose is to define the fight, to define the arena in which we must struggle for integrity and authenticity, to indicate by my own affirmations that I believe there is a possibility of change and in the direction of obedience taking place, but not for one moment to suggest that the particular answers or the particular ways in which we in our parish have shaped our missionary structures are ones that you want to copy or may have relevance at all, but rather that the inner city is a mirror which reflects the problem, the nature of the fight, and suggests a fight into which you must enter. And insofar as I have any specific suggestions, they are to be taken in the form of parables, indication that the fight can be waged, that there are answers to be found, but the answers must be found in each particular situation. And while it's very easy for me to reflect on the specifics of our situation, I can't reflect on the specifics for your situation. That kind of specific appropriation and understanding and direction is your problem, and I can't pretend to provide any specific help in that direction. Now, today, the topic is the Bible as the living covenant. I suggested that we are politicians. We are called to enter into God's task of making and keeping men truly human. It's exciting when you make this affirmation to discover what a political book the Bible is. As one looks at the whole story of the Old and New Testament, the very language in which the Bible is written are political terms. It is about a God who brings his people out of bondage, a very secular bondage, to a very powerful human ruler. And in the process of a secular freedom, calling them from bondage into freedom, God makes himself known. There is a covenant, a constitution, if you will, by which God sets forth the relationships between himself and his people. The story of the Old Testament is the story of conquest, of kings, of the struggle of men to organize themselves into communities that are obedient to a Lord. The metaphors of the Bible are political ones, and the climax of the story is, if you will, political through and through. It is about a kingdom. It is about a Savior. It is about a Lord and obedience to him. These are political terms. The Bible is the constitution, then, if you will, of God's people. Now, I take it for granted that we don't have to debate the significance and centrality of the Bible for the life of the church. But I, at least, have come out of a tradition that gave the Bible fairly short change. The Bible has been primarily taken in the circles in which I have moved for two reasons. First, it has been a book that has been a familiar source of comfort and piety to those who have been brought up within the traditional Christian faith. That is, people who know the familiar and well-loved Psalms and who turn to very carefully selected and very limited parts of the Bible, who know the story of the Good Samaritan and some of the familiar New Testament stories, but who have looked at the Bible as a source of their own personal devotional life, including clergy. The second basis of the Bible has been, of course, a source from which to which we have turned for our sermon, a source book for the preacher, the substance out of which his preaching must come. Now, I'm trying to suggest that at least two more elements are important as one looks at the missionary structure of the congregation. That in some sense, and I will have to confess that as a congregationalist, this has come as something of a shock, that the Bible must be seen as normative for missionary structure. It's been a rather chastening experience in these columns to be given freedom to experiment. And the kind of experimentation to which a couple of my imaginative colleagues have entered into are enough to make one shudder. We have brought in a casket at New Year's Eve and buried the old year, scaring our congregation half to death for fear there was a real body in it that might leap out. We have tried all kinds of worship patterns. We have tried many different forms and structures. But increasingly it has become obvious that the things that stick tend to be shaped very much by the experience of the old or the new Israel. And while I am not aware of any definitive and clear and unambiguous pattern for the life of the church in the New Testament, there certainly seem to be criteria suggested in the New Testament for the structures of the church. And that it is only at our peril that we fail to take the New Testament as a serious source in trying to ask about what a congregation should be and do. For example, I suppose no passage in the Bible has been of more help to us than the second chapter of the book of Acts, where it speaks about the gathering of the church in the synagogue and in homes, and where it speaks about the task of Christians as to the breaking of bread, the fellowship, the apostolic teaching, and the prayer, leaving one to wonder whether a congregation in its gathered life has anything else that it's called to be and to do except to engage in the four aspects of this task. So that, in a real sense, to look upon the Bible as, in some sense, normative or temporal for missionary structures themselves. The second thing is a little harder for me, even now, after a good many years of intensive Bible study, to understand, and that is to speak of the eyes of faith. To recognize that somehow, in East Harlem, we are looking at a world in which we believe that Jesus Christ is Lord. And while I shall talk about this more, I want to affirm my strong conviction. Somehow we have to make sense out of the affirmation that Jesus Christ is Lord, not of the church, but of the church and of the world. And that we are called to look at the world as the place in which God is at work in Christ. An intriguing phrase comes from George MacLeod of the Iona Community, who suggested once in a lecture that we should read the morning newspaper to see what God is doing in the world. Now, this has, at the time he said it, had about no reality to me whatsoever. I read the morning newspaper to see what happened to the New York Mets, so that's usually a foregone conclusion these days, to see what inning it happened. But the idea that one is really looking at the world through eyes so focused by one's faith that one sees really the world in terms of eyes focused by one's knowledge of Jesus Christ. That, if you will, the Bible is a book of secular wisdom. That one has insight into the mysteries of what's happening in the world. I take first chapter of Ephesians. Second chapter of Ephesians, seriously at this point, that to be a Christian means, perhaps more than anything else, that one understands what it is that God is doing in the world. That we have insight into the mysteries of God's purposes. We know what history is all about and where it's going. We know what it means to be a man and what human life is all about. This is the peculiar wisdom which we share. Now, it's all very easy for one to pick up these